This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all of its forms. I'm Stephen Westcott, sitting in as host this week for Peter Burley, who will join us a little later in the program. Coming up, from coast to coast, high-speed rail projects are underway. Will they reduce traffic congestion and help the environment? Population experts say the 6 billionth human will enter the world on or about the second week of October. Two experts talk about whether the U.S. is doing its part to slow population growth. We put an ear to the ground to hear about the efforts of the Wildlands Project. And Chinook salmon are swimming upstream to spawn in Oregon. They've traveled 500 miles from the ocean to mate, but will soon die. These stories and more are coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Stephen Westcott. Smog is a problem that a lot of cities have had to contend with over the years. Officials in California and the Los Angeles area in particular have battled the problem for a long time. Cleaner burning gasoline has helped, and a commuter rail system has been constructed in parts of LA in hopes of further reducing traffic congestion and the pollution it causes. Now a high-speed rail system is being proposed for parts of the Golden State, which could further reduce automobile emissions. Mark Brody reports on that effort and a similar project in the northeastern United States.
Officials in California are hoping to make the sound of an ordinary train obsolete. The California State Legislature formed the state's High-Speed Rail Authority to plan for the construction of a high-speed train which would connect the northern and southern parts of the state. The starting and ending cities have yet to be finalized. The plan calls for between 600 and 700 miles of rail lines for trains capable of traveling at approximately 200 miles an hour. The Rail Authority's executive director, Mehdi Morshed, says California is looking at a large population increase within the next 20 years.
People are going to travel. You have to provide them with the facilities to serve their travel demand. We traditionally depend on automobile primarily for people's travel and supplemented by airplanes for longer trips. But primarily we depend on automobile. Is this the way we want to continue to live? And if we did, how much land, how much air, and how much energy would be using for those kinds of services?
Morshed says, according to estimates, California could grow by as many as 18 million people in the next two decades. And he says if people are going to travel, a high-speed rail service is the most environmentally friendly way to do it. That sentiment is shared by other proponents of high-speed trains. Ann Chettle is with the High-Speed Ground Transportation Association, an international organization advocating the use of high-speed rail in North America and around the world. She says the level of transportation congestion in the U.S. is reaching a critical state.
We're looking at a definite problem in our transportation alternatives. At this time, we have tremendous gridlock on the roads, wing lock, as is sometimes referred to, in the air. We need to have an alternative, and high-speed rail, more and more people are realizing, is that alternative.
For the most part, high-speed trains have more supporters than opponents. John Holtzclaw, chair of the Sierra Club's National Transportation Committee, says his organization is in favor of plans like the one in California, but he says there are a few environmental concerns that should be addressed.
Natural habitat not be disrupted, either being split in half or allowing other species to get into areas of habitat and invade those areas. And the other concern that we have is that the stations not be surrounded by huge parking lots and be an inducement to sprawl.
Both of those concerns have been addressed by the California High-Speed Rail Authority. Executive Director Morshed says more land would be taken if the state decided to build more freeways. He says the issue of sprawl is a valid concern, but Morshed says people are going to live where they want, regardless of whether or not there's train service. California isn't the only high-speed rail project on the table. Amtrak is currently working in the Northeast Corridor on train service, which can travel at speeds up to 150 miles an hour. Jim Waddington of Amtrak says the Boston to Washington, D.C. route is one of the most heavily traveled in the country. He says high-speed rail can have a substantial environmental benefit.
We're looking at it in reduction in terms of air traffic of about 1.5 million air passengers. We're looking at a reduction in the terms of highway traffic in excess of 2%, which would improve regional air quality. And in addition, with the electrification from New Haven to Boston, we're looking at running electric locomotives as opposed to diesel locomotives, which would reduce air pollution.
Amtrak's plan for the Northeast Corridor is seen as a test of whether or not passengers will use the new systems. But the High-Speed Ground Transportation Association's Ann Chettle says high-speed rail service from Washington, D.C. to New York City is more convenient than traveling by plane.
Let's say I were to fly to New York. I would have to take a taxi to the airport, which takes about 45 minutes. Wait in the terminal for at least an hour, because they tell you you have to. Then you possibly face a delay. Then you take your flight, which, you know, it's only about an hour flight. But then you have to take another cab drive from New York's LaGuardia or Kennedy, which will take you another 45 minutes to an hour. Well, think about it this way. You're downtown already because you're probably working. Union Station is about a 10-minute either metro ride or cab ride. You don't have to wait. You take your train, which takes about 2 hours, and you're in downtown New York City. You've eliminated at least three steps from your travel time. That, I think, is one of the big sellers of high-speed trains.
In the Northeast, Amtrak is planning on having service running between Boston and New York City in October, with the rest of the Northeast Corridor not far behind. The next step in California is for the High-Speed Rail Authority to try and sell the plan to the governor and state legislature. If that happens by the end of the year, high-speed trains could be running by the year 2020. Reporting for The Environment Show, I'm Mark Brody.
Sometime in October, world population is projected to reach the 6 billion mark. This means there are more than three times as many of us on the planet as there were at the beginning of the century. Conventional wisdom teaches that limiting population growth is critical if we are to achieve a sustainable planet and a higher standard of living for people in the developing world. Collectively, within the last decade, the nations of the world pledged to support policies to provide family planning assistance on a global basis at both the UN Conference on the Environment and Development in Rio and subsequently at the UN Conference on Population and the Environment held in Cairo. Dramatic reductions in birth rates have taken place in a number of developing countries like Mexico. The reductions are partly due to increased availability of family planning services. Despite this, funding for international planning services is strongly opposed by some members of Congress, so the United States has not fulfilled the commitments it made to the international community. Peter Burley recently discussed current problems in funding for family planning programs with two advocates who lobbied the issue on Capitol Hill.
I'm speaking with Pat Walk from the National Audubon Society and Dan Pellegrim from Pathfinder International. When it comes to securing the funds through the American political process for population programs, family planning programs, foreign aid designed to limit population growth, we have had tremendous difficulties. Pat is a longtime lobbyist and battler with the Congress. What does the situation look like now, and what can be done by folk who want to see greater U.S. effort expended in these programs?
Well, I'd like to start by saying that one of the things that we need to remember is that when we went to Cairo 5 years ago, we, with other donors, made a commitment to come up with one-third of the money that needed to be available for the Cairo agenda.
And when you say we, you're talking about the United States.
United States,
right.
Government. And we've just gone through a five-year review process, and what that review process has told us is that when the developing countries themselves agree to put up two-thirds of their share, they have done so. But we, being the donor countries, have not met our promise or our commitment of that one-third, and the U.S. certainly has not. Our original commitment was at a level of equal to 0.7% of our gross national product. For those of us who've been working on this for quite some time, we had hoped that by the year 2000 we would be up to $1.2 billion in U.S. funding for international population and family planning services. Now, that's to set the target. The fact is that we have just, we have a bill now that may come up for a vote shortly, which basically appropriates $385 million plus an additional $25 million for the UN Population Fund. So you can see that's a House bill. The Senate bill is a little higher than that, $400 million for Population and Family Planning Services separately from the $25 million. But you can see we're far, far below what we thought, where we thought we would be. And the battle has not changed much. I mean, the same kind of rhetoric and arguments that went on, say, 5 years ago over these programs and these services are the same arguments that are going on today.
Dan, do you see any means of shifting that, or are we simply stalled in the water until the current generation of political leadership in the Congress retires?
Well, I hope we're not stalled because we can't afford to be. The opportunity right now is an incredible one, with a billion of the world's 6 billion people being teenagers and moving into reproductive years. It's a critical time for us to move the family planning agenda and to advance the envelope on this issue. So I think we, people who care about this issue, need to work in intensely to make sure that we're not stalled. But in fact, we have to acknowledge the truth may set us free, but it's also a pretty bitter pill. The truth is that the U.S. government support for international family planning has declined by 30% in the last 3 years. So we're not exactly haven't been headed in the right direction. As my colleague Pat Walk has just indicated, it's a bit better picture in this House, and the Senate version would even improve that slightly.
But Pat,
it's a long way short of where we need to be.
One of the problems we've seen is that every time this issue comes up, it gets all wrapped up in the abortion question. And family rights advocates have said, in terms of our international activity, we have no problem making sure that none of this is applied toward abortions. And yet the matter still stalls. Is there any way of getting that separation clear in the minds of the political powers so that one could go forward with family planning?
It'd be nice to get it separated. I'm afraid that our adversaries like to connect it because they get more political mileage by keeping it connected. It's imperative to point out that the delivery of family planning services in developing countries does more to reduce the need for abortion services. And the reliance on abortion, we can prove, is declined where contraceptive services are made available. So it's a counterproductive effort. In Russia, once contraceptives became available in 1990, abortions fell by more than one-third.
Pat, do you see any way politically of making this separation in the United States?
Well, I think that there are members of Congress who are representing very specifically certain lobbies in this country who may have a problem with abortion, but ultimately I think that, you know, there's a bigger problem that goes more deeply in terms of attitudes towards women, and it's a whole separate discussion that we could have. But I think that what has to be done is that the American public needs to understand what Dan just said, and that is that when family planning services are available, it reduces the incidence of abortion. And that's been my experience in most developing countries. The cases of abortion I've seen is where women felt that they had no other recourse. We need to educate people to that, and they need to say to their members of Congress, this is not about abortion. There are only two ways I see we can get around it. There are people in the Congress we cannot convince because their agendas are much bigger than just the abortion issue. So we have to put as much pressure as we can on those who can understand the difference, and quite frankly, perhaps get some other people to run for Congress.
Okay. I've been speaking with Pat Walk, who is senior advisor to the National Audubon Society on population issues, and Dan Pellegrin, president of Pathfinder International.
The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. If you heard something you liked, we'd love to hear about it. Or even if you heard something you did not like, contact us. Our comment line is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Send us a note by snail mail. Our address is The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206.
Fleming, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, the Wildlands Project is an organization dedicated to preserving ecosystems in the new millennium. It's a group that provides services to the conservation community. The Wildlands Project, located in Tucson, Arizona, which was started 9 years ago, was created for the purpose of developing an agenda for the next millennium that involves maintenance and restoration of nature throughout North America. That's according to Wildlands Project President Harvey Locke.
And the Wildlands Project's role is really to be a catalyst for the entire conservation movement in this direction, and we're really pleased that we're having that kind of an impact, and that many other organizations are sort of embracing the Wildlands Project principles and applying them on the ground in their regions, which is the idea from the beginning. Rather than competing with other organizations, we provide a service to the conservation movement.
Locke says the Wildlands Project was originally started by Earth First members, a radical environmental group, and some conservation biologists who were concerned with how to prevent the heightened extinction crisis around the world. Currently, 20 members sit on the organization's international board. They are scientists and environmentalists from other groups that are committed to improving ecosystems. The way the Wildlands Project works on restoring nature is through what it calls rewilding, or creating reserve designs. Harvey Locke.
These are science-based reserve designs that have the goal of identifying where core protected areas should be for wildlife and where the corridor should be to connect those core areas to each other, so that instead of having isolated patches around the landscape, which become little islands of extinction, we have a free-flowing web of life up and down and across the continent. Reserve designs are done by scientists coming together and looking at what the various species are, saying, well, if we wanted to protect something like a grizzly bear, how much area do we need to do that? Where are the key areas of habitat that we want to protect? And then how do we need to make sure that it can move between one patch of habitat and another? Or we'll take a bird and take a look at the needs of that bird species and say, okay, how will that bird be best served by a reserve design system that ensures that it can continue to survive and meet its needs for feeding and finding mate.
The Wildlands Project scientists have developed a conservation theory and works with about 25 groups from the UK to Central America to assist the groups work out logistics on a project and funding. Primary issues surrounding wildland conservation are the loss of wilderness and the loss of secure wildlife habitat, according to Locke.
The more roads and the more persecution you have of animals, the less likelihood they have of surviving. But this is particularly so for large carnivores like grizzly bears and wolves and cougars. And although cougars can survive if they're not persecuted more easily than the others. And so the idea of the Wildlands Project is to say, well, how do we meet the needs of these animals, like large carnivores? Because not only are they important for themselves, but there's also, at least in some systems, natural systems, a clear connection between large carnivores being present and the health of the entire ecosystem, not just the large carnivore like the grizzly bear or the wolf, but also all the things and other living things in the system.
In the past, some conservation has been done without focusing on all the elements, and the result has been that we lose other species when we don't maintain a mix of all the species. for example, from the west coast of North America.
Where there are no sea otters, which is a carnivore, the sea urchin populations explode. And when the sea urchin populations explode, they eat all the kelp. And when all the kelp is gone, all the various fish species that live in kelp disappear. So the key to maintaining the healthy west coast environment right along the edge of the ocean there is kelp, and the key to maintaining kelp is sea otters. So what we are interested in is maintaining all the elements in the landscape, and where they're not present, we want to rewild or put them back in. For example, in Yellowstone, the wolf was recently reintroduced after being gone for a long time. You reintroduce the wolf, and that has interesting effects on restoring the health of the system. It's made the elk more wary. There's some evidence that the willows along the streams are coming back because the elk were down there eating the willows more than they probably should. But the result of putting the wolves back in is the elk are more wary, and the willow areas are recovering. Coyotes' numbers are going down, and the number of things that coyotes eat are going up, and that's increasing the population of birds in the sky, like hawks and so on, apparently. So it's pretty exciting how these dynamics work.
Locke says the typical situation is that landscapes are most affected where there are the most people. So Locke concludes that the goal for the Wildlands Project in the new millennium is to keep the landscape wild where it is wild and renew landscapes where species have disappeared. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Leah Fleming.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. In the northeastern corner of Oregon, Chinook salmon are beginning to swim upstream to spawn. The fish are migrating out of the large deep pools in the middle fork of the John Day River, which is a tributary of the Columbia River. The salmon spent the summer in the pools conserving energy for the spawning season. That's according to Christian Torgerson, a fish ecologist and PhD candidate in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at Oregon State University.
The salmon move out of their deep water habitats and locate areas with coarse gravel where there's usually some subsurface flow to keep aeration going in the eggs. And they dig a red, which is the word for a salmon nest, by using their tail and digging out a depression in the bottom of the stream. And then that's the female who does that first. And she waits there for males to come along.
Christian says the females then begin sizing up possible mates.
The female has to be convinced that the male is worthy. So there'll be fairly complex behavioral interactions between the male and female as the male approaches the red and sees her and she sees him. And if she's convinced that he is the one, and sometimes it takes the male actually fighting with other males to convince the female that he's the best, the biggest and the strongest. And when that happens, the female lays her eggs, and the male is right there next to her when she lays the eggs, and he releases the milt or sperm to fertilize the eggs.
Scientists call this form of reproduction external fertilization. Typically, female Chinook salmon will deposit 3,000 to 14,000 eggs in the gravel. Once the eggs are fertilized, mama uses her tail to cover them up with rocks. Males and females die after spawning, and their carcasses become food for a variety of species and add nutrients to the aquatic ecosystem. The young Chinook salmon develop using nutrients in a yolk sac and eventually emerge in the early spring.
These fry will emerge from the gravel, and depending upon the amount of cover and the amount of eddies in the system, these fry will move downstream with the current, but they will live and grow in the headwaters of the Middle Fork John Day until fall, when they're a little bit bigger and ready to leave the smaller tributaries for the bigger rivers.
Torgerson says juvenile Chinook salmon, called smolts, are about 8 inches in length at 1 year of age. They're growing and undergoing changes that will allow them to move from freshwater rivers to the ocean. These Chinooks remain at sea until they are 4 to 5 years old. At that age, they'll begin the 500-mile trip from the ocean to the middle fork of the John Day River. Habitat loss and other forces have contributed to the decline of this population, and now only 100 to 150 are returning annually to spawn. Chinook salmon are amazing creatures. Sometimes swimming 20 miles a day, they have a tremendous drive to reach the spawning grounds. Also, many Chinook salmon return to the site where they were born to spawn. It's a unique characteristic considering the animals have no compasses or maps to help them. And it's a good thing humans did not acquire this trait. Imagine how long the lines would be at doctor's offices. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Stephen Westcott. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Stephen Westcott. Still ahead, can we cut emissions, improve the environment, and promote job growth at the same time? The World Wildlife Fund says we can, but some industry representatives remain skeptical. Freezing DNA, test tube gorillas, and mating Sumatran rhinos, they're all part of efforts to help species from becoming extinct. In the first of a two-part series on endangered species breeding programs, we look at what's happening at the Cincinnati Zoo and the Audubon Institute in New Orleans. It's a lot more than just sticking a male and female in a cage with the hope that they like each other. And we listen to the comment line. Stay with us.
We are Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to be asking the question whether we can cut greenhouse gas emissions and reduce the threat of climate change, and what impact that will have on the U.S. economy. At the U.N. Conference on Climate Change almost 3 years ago in Kyoto, the United States and countries of Western Europe agreed to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 7% below 1990 levels, and they said they were going to do that by the year 2010. Since then, our emissions have actually gone up, and the Kyoto Agreement, which was vigorously opposed by major players in both the U.S. energy and manufacturing sectors, has been a subject of continuing dispute. Those who opposed it argued that to achieve the reductions, jobs would be lost and the U.S. economy would be put into a tailspin. Recently, the World Wildlife Fund has published a study which shows that by meeting the Kyoto commitments, the U.S. economy and employment could actually grow, and that we could double the reduction and grow even more. So to discuss this, we have two experts with us. Jennifer Morgan, she is Climate Campaign Director for the World Wildlife Fund. It's an environmental organization which published the report. And Glenn Kelly, he is Executive Director of the Global Climate Coalition. It's made up of trade associations and private companies. It's a group which has been skeptical about global warming projections and also opposed the Kyoto Agreement in its current form. What I'd like to do is start with you, Jennifer, from World Wildlife. You say an aggressive global warming policy could produce both savings and jobs. Tell us a little bit about how you come to that conclusion.
Sure. What we asked the TELUS Institute in Boston, an economics institute, to do was to look at where we could achieve some reductions in the economy. Where are there gaps? Where are there inefficiencies? And what types of policies would we need to put together to bring our emissions down? And what would the economic impact be? And how that would that impact jobs? And what we found was that by making our cars and trucks more efficient, our power plants more efficient, we could actually reduce emissions quite significantly and put money back in people's pockets. For example, if you don't have to pay as much at the gas pump for your gasoline, for your sport utility vehicle, or for your car, that's more money you can spend somewhere else. Or if you don't have to spend as much money on your utility bills because the utility is burning energy more efficiently, that's other money that you can put in your pocket and spend elsewhere in the economy. So what we found was actually that by going beyond the targets that are required in the Kyoto Protocol, that there would be as much as $43 billion per year gain for the U.S. economy and 870,000 new jobs created, which would add up to about $400 more per household for every American home.
Glenn Kelly from the Global Climate Coalition, you folks see this totally differently, as I understand it. What is wrong with the analysis that you've just heard?
Well, we do, Pierre, see it quite a bit differently. I've read the report and have to say it's very well written, but unfortunately has a number of fantastic assumptions in terms of the types of policies and the kind of progress that we can make in a very limited period of time. All the credible economic analysis that we've seen to date indicates, including from the Clinton administration, very substantial harm to the U.S. economy from Kyoto-like targets.
All right. Now, take me through that specifically. How does the economy get hurt if you do the kinds of things that Jennifer is talking about?
It doesn't get hurt if you do it in the right way, and it's a long-term approach. You know, our member companies are presently trying to find ways to have more efficient performing automobiles, more efficient uses of energy that will, in the long run, save money and create additional jobs. That's already underway. Problem is if you got a short-term target timetable like the Kyoto Protocol calls for, 2010, and you mandate those reductions, that's where you start interfering with the U.S. economy.
Jennifer, the argument about mandates is that when you tell people to do something, they don't like it, and if they do it by themselves, they get there faster and more efficiently. What kind of assumptions did you make in your study about that?
Well, we basically went on a sector-by-sector basis and looked at, for example, in the transportation sector, the fact that cars and the requirements for how efficient, how many miles per gallon a car has to get on a gallon of gasoline, that those requirements haven't been updated since the mid-70s. And so what we assumed was that there would be a requirement, a policy that would say that cars had to be made more efficiently. And actually, we're seeing that happening right now by a couple of Japanese automakers that are putting cars on the market this year and next year that'll get 50, 60 miles per gallon. And in our study, we actually only assumed that it would go up to 42 miles per gallon. So that's one example of kind of the what we thought was a realistic proposal out there that would, you know, kind of close that gap and bring the technology forward, with the auto manufacturer being able to figure out how to make those changes, but that they would be mandated to do so. And it seems that some companies are already moving that way in the U.S. The Ford Motor Company, it seems, is developing the technology to improve their fuel economy of their trucks by as much as 15%. So it's there, it's on the shelves, but what we're saying is we need a little bit of extra oomph, i.e. a regulation, to get it off the shelf and give consumers the choice to have more efficient cars and trucks.
Glenn, is it your view that this simply shouldn't be happening through government intervention, or that it just can't happen, the kinds of savings that would be required to meet the Kyoto Accords can't be achieved anyway?
Using Jennifer's example there, I mean, it's already happening right now, not with government intervention, but with government partnership. U.S. automakers are currently producing, in partnership with the government, new generation vehicles that are going to get to much higher levels of fuel economy standards over time. You know, some of the advances are being made right now and are, as Jennifer says, on the shelf. Problem is they're extraordinarily expensive to produce. The technologies that are going into this they're just not ready for the market at this time.
Now, people hearing that are somewhat skeptical, because I remember when seatbelts were going to be so expensive you couldn't put them in, and airbags were going to be so expensive. I mean, we've heard it all. Why is the auto industry more credible this time than it was when it said all those things before that turned out to be not so?
Well, I've got to let the auto industry speak for itself.
Okay.
Think back to the price of a Nintendo when it first came out. It was quite a bit. Home computers were quite high. Over time, these prices come down, and consumers are able to afford them. But if you start mandating that consumers have to buy these mandated automobiles before they're ready for the market, the costs are going to hit the pocketbooks pretty hard.
Well, but they are ready for the market. I think that's the difference here, that Toyota is putting the Prius on the market at a reasonable price of, you know, $17,000, which is a car that's going to get probably 55 miles per gallon. That's what it's tested in the U.S. So the technology is there, and it seems to me that the U.S. manufacturers are just going to get in the situation again that they had in the 70s, where they don't meet the challenge, and U.S. technology is left behind. And what our report is saying is, well, let's get that U.S. leadership out there and ensure markets for U.S. products across the world, so that Honda and Toyota, very solid companies, and I applaud them for their efforts, but that they're not getting all the market share.
I'd like to shift this slightly, because we are talking about achieving the Kyoto levels with either economic growth or economic failure, depending on whose side of this you take. Since about half of our electricity is generated by coal, and I think everybody agrees that coal is one of the big emitters of greenhouse gas emissions, specifically CO2, how did you, Jennifer, look at the electrical situation as you made projections about meeting Kyoto levels and saving money at the same time?
Well, what we did in the electric sector was put in a cap on the emissions of carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, and then fine particulate emissions, so that you get a benefit in air pollution and global warming pollution at the same time.
Now, for people who don't understand that, you just said we will legislate the amount that you can spit
that,
out.
That there would be a law passed. Right.
How do you look at that, Glenn, remembering that the older plants are grandfathered, they don't have to meet the standards of new plants. Do you oppose regulatory action that might achieve some of this?
Well, you know, it's important to point out in terms of this whole discussion about what the Kyoto Protocol calls for and what it does not call for. The utility industry here in the United States will have reduced greenhouse gas emissions by, I think the number is close to 170 million tons through efficiency and process improvements by the year 2000. They're taking actions and voluntary actions. And it's important to bear in mind the Kyoto Protocol leaves out developing countries like China and Mexico and Brazil, where these types of regulations would not apply to the same types of coal-producing power plants there. So I don't know what kind of economic benefit or environmental benefit we get by taking on those obligations alone.
Now, is it your argument that since other people are not yet on board, that we should not go through the exercise of reducing our emissions? Is that what I heard you saying?
No, I think, you know, as we've pointed out for a number of years now, the Kyoto Protocol excludes a lot of developing nations that these regulations would not apply to. And we would witness quite clearly, and history would prove the point, I'm sure, complete migration of some of the larger industries in this country to countries that had less costly regulatory programs. And with those industries would go the jobs and the incomes that support American households.
Jennifer, where do you come out on that one?
Well, I think it's important to look at this on two sides. First of all, economic analysis by the World Resources Institute shows that the sectors that actually have energy costs, which is what we're talking about here, as a major part of their expenditures are very small. We're talking about things like cement, aluminum, very energy-intensive sectors that are less likely to pick up and move from the United States than others. And the second piece of that is that what I said before, that I think that there are tremendous opportunities in markets around the world, and if the U.S. does not move ahead and develop the technologies, they're going to be losing market share and actually having an economics loss over the next number of years. You know, if you really look at the electricity sector and you look back to the acid rain debate and how much it was supposedly going to cost then to bring down those emissions up to $25 billion, according to some estimates, now it's $1 billion. It's under $1 billion. So I think we're in the midst of this he said, she said kind of a
okay. Let's do he said, she said on another issue. In your report, Jennifer, you talk about jobs, and you indicate that not only would we be 870,000 jobs ahead if we moved more aggressively to curb gas emissions, but that there would be a gain of 94,900 in California, 67,000 in Texas, and 49,000 in New York. Where do those numbers come from?
Those numbers are basically taken from the national numbers, and then we took a series of estimates or a series of indicators. We looked at the differences in energy prices in states. We looked at the level of energy consumed for each dollar of economic activity in the state, so how much do you spend on energy? And then we looked at the number of energy-related jobs as a percentage of how many jobs there were totally in the state, and went down from there. So it's a rough estimate of the breakdown from that 900,000 number to a state-by-state assessment.
Obviously, jobs are the currency of the day in a political season. Glenn, what would you say to a presidential candidate who says, look at these great job numbers, should I go this route?
I would point out to the, again, all the credible economic studies that have been done to date, including the study by the Clinton administration's own Energy Information Administration, and some work that we've had done through another economic forecasting firm that predicts completely opposite of what Jennifer reports. California job loss at 278,000, Texas 125,000, and New York 140,000 jobs lost. Again, these are consistent with the administration's own numbers.
Now, to get an understanding of where they come from, Jennifer, I gather you're talking about an increase which you see new technology will create as people are building more stuff and more efficient machines and that sort of thing. The job loss that you see, Glenn, comes from what?
It's a complete reduction in the use of energy mandated that leads to much higher consumer costs, much higher production costs, and migration of businesses overseas where those jobs are going to go because it'd be cheaper to do business and make products to sell back here in the United States.
Just one point here. I mean,
sure.
First of all, there's a number of studies that are very consistent with this TELUS study, including the National Academy of Sciences, the Office of Technology Assessment, all of the national labs that have put out that are very consistent with these types of studies that the TELUS Institute has done. And the other really important point is to look at the assumptions of these different models. To my knowledge, the studies that Glenn is talking about basically take a top-down approach where they put a tax, a high energy tax, and that's the one tool that they use to change behavior to try and meet this Kyoto target. And then they don't use the money generated from that tax for anything else.
We've been discussing the economic impact of meeting the Kyoto standards to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I want to thank our guests, Jennifer Morgan from the World Wildlife Fund and Glenn Kelly from the Global Climate Coalition. We know that you have some thoughts about that, so give us a call. Our telephone number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Again, we've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley.
Are you concerned about the health of the planet? We want to hear what you have to say. Contact us via email. The address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Our website address is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. Scientists across the globe say the planet is experiencing the largest mass extinction of plant and animal species since the dinosaur age. Habitat loss is a major cause, and now some countries are trying to preserve ecologically sensitive areas. In addition to conservation efforts, scientists are looking to another tool as a way to bring species back from the brink of extinction. They are endangered species breeding programs operated by zoos and other research facilities. Dr. Terry Roth is director of research at the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden. She is also head of CREW, the Center for Research of Endangered Wildlife located at the zoo. Roth says researchers at CREW are using a variety of techniques to propagate species that are threatened. Natural methods are being combined with modern technologies to breed Sumatran rhinos.
The Sumatran rhinoceros, if you introduce a male and a female, when the female is not receptive for breeding, we can get some very fierce, aggressive fighting that goes on between the two. And in captivity, in a smaller enclosure, that becomes very dangerous to the animals. So what we needed to do was learn how to determine when that female was going to be receptive to a male and would breed with a male and introduce them only on that particular day or days. And so we've used all of our research just to learn about the reproductive cycle of the female Sumatran rhinoceros. And now we time our introductions for breeding, and they're timed introductions, and it's based on actual research, hormone values, and data about what's going on the ovaries of that animal.
Oftentimes, zoos will borrow animals from other zoos in hopes of introducing males and females that will mate. Some animals, like the rhinoceros, are bred strictly for captivity, meaning they'll spend their lives in a zoo. But some animals, such as a native of Wyoming that has declined in numbers, are being bred for introduction into the wild by facilities like the Cincinnati Zoo, according to Dr. Roth.
Here at Crewe, we're doing quite a bit of work with amphibians now. And, for example, the endangered Wyoming toad is one of the species that we've worked on quite a bit. And in that case, when we produce tadpoles or toadlets, those animals are already being reintroduced into Wyoming.
Besides natural breeding, artificial insemination, the process where sperm is collected and inserted into a female, is a method being used by scientists. Another is in vitro fertilization, that's the so-called test tube baby, where sperm and eggs are taken, mixed in a test tube, and inserted into a surrogate mother. In vitro fertilization appears even more promising to some, as Crewe and others create their own cryopreservation facilities. These are large freezers or frozen zoos where sperm, eggs, and other DNA material from plants and animals can be stored for future use. The Cincinnati Zoo currently has about 60 animal and 1,000 plant species in its frozen zoo. Bill Swanson, head of Crewe's Animal Research Division, has been using this method to help wildlife officials in South America reproduce a particular cat that is threatened with extinction. Again, Dr. Roth.
And we have quite a number of embryos now that we've been able to produce and freeze, and we're about to take that last big step, which is to transfer some of those embryos to recipient ocelots to try and produce offspring. So he has been able to produce ocelots by artificial insemination, and we're now just trying to get the in vitro fertilization and embryo transfer system to work. So we're right at that point. We've got the embryos in our frozen zoo, and we'll probably be transferring them in the next couple of months, actually.
The Audubon Institute in New Orleans, Louisiana, not affiliated with the National Audubon Society, is considered to be one of the world's leaders in the breeding of endangered species. In 1996, the Institute created ACRES, or the Audubon Center for Research of Endangered Species. The 38,000-square-foot facility was constructed mostly with $15 million from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Dr. Betsy Dresser is Senior Vice President of Research at ACRES. The world-renowned scientist actually worked at the Cincinnati Zoo before joining the ACRES team. Dresser and her colleagues are credited with producing the first test tube lowland gorilla baby through in vitro fertilization. The staff was also the first to transport frozen embryos from one continent to be inserted to wild animals in another. Last year, they took frozen embryos from captive bongo antelopes, which are rare, over to Africa. They inserted them into eland antelopes, a species that's numbers are stable. Even though no elands gave birth to bongo antelopes, Dr. Dresser and her staff will try again in the coming weeks.
We had an interest in trying to do embryo transfer in antelope, and what we decided to do was try to do what we call interspecies embryo transfer, where you transfer embryos of a very rare or threatened species into a common species, a surrogate mother, if you will. They have to be close relatives, we found out. So what we want to do is use the eland as a surrogate, and we were able to do that in captivity. And so now what we're doing is we're taking embryos from New Orleans to Kenya, and we're taking bongo embryos in a frozen state, and we're transferring them into eland there, which will be eventually released into the wild, and hopefully these babies will be born into the wild.
Dresser has had previous success with interspecies breeding, such as propagating endangered Indian desert cats by using domestic cats as surrogate mothers. She admits that not every program is successful and says whenever you have a new science, you'll encounter failures and setbacks. But the science gained by Dresser and others who are breeding endangered species will undoubtedly expand our understanding of what humans will be able to do in the future as more plant and animal species are lost. Dr. Dresser believes cryopreservation will play a key role.
And I think as stewards of wildlife, I think we need to be greatly concerned that we have got to develop some new methods of reproducing these species and keeping those species once we reproduce them. And I think that's why this whole, if you look at the technology, this whole frozen zoo concept is so important, because really what you're doing is you're freezing the DNA of these animals. They're not taking up space in zoos, or who knows, with all the destruction of wildlife habitat, what's going to happen? Is man really going to wake up and save it, or are we just going to overpopulate this planet? I think this whole frozen zoo concept has something to be seriously considered, and that is we can revive these species if we know how to freeze them and thaw them.
The idea of freezing embryos and bringing them back to life in the future may be unsettling to some folks. It brings to mind a scenario depicted in the movie Jurassic Park, where frozen DNA material is used to produce formerly extinct creatures that then begin gobbling up humans. This is unlikely to happen anytime soon, but it leaves one to wonder what could happen as humans manipulate genetic material. Is restoring biodiversity on the planet worth any risks involved? If lower forms of life are dying out, will we begin trying to propagate them, too? If habitats are gone, does propagating species make sense, or should all of this money be directed to preserving ecologically sensitive areas? In part two of our series on endangered species breeding programs, we'll hear about efforts at the Bronx and San Diego zoos and look at some of the other big issues involved in saving plants and animals from extinction. Time now to hear what some of our listeners are saying. Here's Susan Arbetter.
A listener by the name of Janice called our comment line after hearing a Talking Green discussion on whether conservation efforts in the United States contribute to deforestation.
I was much interested in the story about lumbering in the throughout the world, but I was surprised that there was absolutely no mention of recycling of papers. How significant is that? I'm lugging my papers to the recycling center regularly, and I wonder if it's important to do that.
A listener named Steve heard Peter Burley's discussion with Bill Nye, host of the public television program Bill Nye, the Science Guy. He had this to say.
We need a lot more Bill Nyes in our public school systems that make science and learning fun, because he might move a little fast for some of the old people, but I'm telling you what, you can't move fast enough for the problems in America with young people not taking an interest in the world around them. So keep going, Bill. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Yeah.
We appreciate all your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can reach our comment line by dialing 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. For the Environment Show, I'm Susan Arbetter.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Stephen Westcott. High-speed rail, family planning, restoring ecosystems, mating Chinook salmon, and breeding bongo antelopes. We covered a lot of material. If you didn't digest it all, get a copy of the show for your notes by calling 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262, and ask for show number 508. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer. Peter Burley is host and creative director. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.